where the school board of 10 members is split 5-5. And you have 5 secular people, unbelievers, pitted against 5 that are young earth creationists. And so the subject of the science curriculum came up and immediately developed at very public school board meetings. This clash between the atheistic materialists who wanted science taught in such a way that there could be no hint mentioned of the supernatural. Science would now have to be taught from a strictly naturalistic perspective, pitted against those people who wanted to bring in the curriculum of the Institute for Creation Research, which would promote the idea that the universe and the earth are only 10,000 years old. And this, of course, was very disturbing to the science teachers who were trying to teach this whole subject. In the midst of all of this, we got contacted by a friend of the president of the school board who was on the naturalist side, but kind of in a difficult spot with these two highly polarized groups and really wanting to try to bring some peace. And she said, well, I happen to know of some scientists with reasons to believe who could really offer some insight here that would avoid the polar extremes. And so plans were in the works for us to actually go to Topeka, Kansas, and talk to these people. However, all that has been sidelined because of what they've agreed to do by way of compromise is simply to delete from the curriculum any discussion that would pertain to evolution, along with it, anything that would pertain to astronomy, because the young earth creationists perceived that astronomy was a threat. Since it talks about distant stars and the Big Bang and all that kind of stuff. And so what's really going on here is that the way they've solved the crisis is simply to delete from their science curriculum a whole swath of scientific content. And so I'm really disturbed by this because the way they decided to solve the problem is let's not teach our students very much science. Okay, we'll just cut this. Anything that's controversial, we'll just cut it right out of the curriculum. And so is this not one reason why of the 13 most advanced nations in the world, the United States ranks dead last in science education and science literacy? And so I'm frankly disappointed that they decided rather than to deal with the issues and maybe bring in some information, they simply decided to delete a lot of science from their curriculum. And boy, wouldn't this be a shame if this began to become a practice for all education. I mean, education, if it's worth anything, should invoke a little bit of controversy. So
biology and geology as well?
Well, no, what they're going to do is they're going to teach biology without reference to creation-evolution issues. And when it came to astronomy, they said, we'll have to delete the whole thing because everything in astronomy is a threat to the young earth creationist position. And in some ways, it's a threat, too, to the atheists because, you know, you've got this beginning of the universe in finite time. Neither one of them really likes it. In fact, I got interviewed in the radio last week about this. And I said, the radio interviewer says, well, you know, he was a secularist, but he was well aware that the second law of thermodynamics is a real challenge to an atheistic interpretation. And I was able to respond that the problem with this is that both young earth creationists and the atheistic materialists are forced into a science paradigm that violates the second law of thermodynamics. And so what we really need to do is get back to some solid science education. Better yet, to teach science in such a way that the students are equipped to deal with issues that come up like this. This won't be the last time. Now, if every time something controversial or disturbing comes up, we say, let's just delete it from the curriculum, then our students will never really be able to develop the tools for dealing with these issues in the future. By the way, not all hope is lost. We're still hoping that maybe in September, October, we can get a meeting going. But just reading from this article, the tenor is they don't want to touch this issue with a 10-foot pole. And, you know, as Fuzz was here last week, he and I were talking about this, and he just raised the speculation of maybe what's going on They're afraid to bring in reasons to believe because we'll offend both sides.
Yeah.
So that may have something to do with it. All right. I'll turn this back over to you. Tom, thank you. Oh, by the way, I wanted to introduce my father to you. He's here, right here. It's my father. And, I could, you won't be able to recognize my son either. Would you stand up, David? He really looks sharp with his sunglasses. So, the occasion for all of these men in black and my father being here is yesterday evening. We had the chance to participate in the wedding of my cousin's daughter. Kathy Dirksen has been to the class here a few times. Got married in our backyard last night. So, naturally, our relatives from Canada came down to celebrate. So, and if I could just speak on behalf of my dad, I mean, I can just tell you, he was very touched by all the letters that you sent to him with the passing of my mother. So, and I know we all really appreciated, Dad, the card that you sent to all of us, just expressing your gratefulness for those responses. So, thank you.
You can leave that here.
I can leave it.
Yeah. I won't steal it, Hugh.
Okay.
I'm fairly trustworthy.
Well, Fuzz asked me to express to you on behalf of his whole family how much he appreciated the hospitality you showed him last week while I was in Houston, and the fact that you asked him such good questions. He really loved being here in the class, and says, Hugh, I hope you're gone a lot more. So... But, yeah, he's got a good sense of humor, so it's fun. And I can't tell you personally how encouraged I am and relieved I am to have Fuzz Rana on our staff. I just recognize with his being on the staff the past 2 months just how much stress I've been carrying trying to lead this Reasons to Believe without any real colleagues that are there with me in the office. It's wonderful to have all these volunteers, but... given the size of our organization. And Fuzz says, hey, the stress isn't gone yet. It's true. We need more, but this is at least a start. And those of you who have been to service know that I gave a quick report on Mongolia and Japan in the service. And the 8 o'clock hour and the 9:30 hour, people come up to me and make a couple of comments. One was, you should tell people that you're putting your radio interviews on your website. I don't believe even this class knows that, but now that we have a radio studio functioning, every time one of our staff people goes on the radio, we capture a high-quality audio tape of the interview, and we immediately put it on our website. So we're archiving our radio programs, and you can see what it's like to deal with all the weirdos that call in over the radio. So... And one of those was none other than Dave Sargent. Thank you for calling in. So, so he was in between the weirdos. So. Well, typically the people that call in are hostile to our point of view, and Dave called in and just offered some real words of encouragement. And so thank you, Dave. So, got one friend out there anyway. But the other thing said, if I could give, because I talked about the new scientific evidences for the God of the Bible in that little clip on Mongolia and Japan. You know, every once in a while I try to give you a little flavor for that, but Kathy reminds me, you pick ones that are short so we can get on with the Genesis. So I think I've picked a couple that are short that I can give you today that are brand new scientific evidences for the Christian faith. And, you know, I learn a lot from my wife, and one of the things she's been coaching me on is, Hugh, give them the bottom line first, then briefly tell them how this discovery came about, then give the bottom line again. So I'm going to try to follow that advice. And I've been picking up since Fuzz has joined our staff just how excited we scientists get about how the discovery was made. And that's what really thrills us about just, you know, the incredible achievement of even getting this discovery. But the point is that the vast majority of laymen don't care two bits about how it was done. They just want to know what happened, what was discovered. So I'm going to try to keep that focus there, all right? And if you want the details, we're going to write about both of these stories if our editor gives us room. And our forthcoming... Well, you know what's wonderful about this magazine we're developing? We're developing a 48-page color magazine. Subscription-based, so we can't give it away for free anymore, but it's going to allow us to write a lot more about the new evidences for the Christian faith. And what excites me is we already got way too much material for the first issue. So this is good news. But the first of these got published just a few days ago in the Astrophysical Journal Letters. And it's got this wonderful title, Strong Field Gravity and X-Ray Observations of 4U1820-30. Okay, and immediately that caught my attention. But I noticed that none of the news agencies have picked up on this story yet. So, but the bottom line is this. This provides one more proof for the accuracy and reliability of a theory of general relativity in an arena where astrophysicists thought there was no hope to come up with it. It's a difficult piece of observation, but they pulled it off, and now we got one more nail for that coffin. You say, why do you call it a coffin? Because the proof for general relativity is equivalent to a proof that Jesus Christ created the universe. And it all comes through the space-time theorem of general relativity, which you've heard me speak about before. Published way back in the Dark Ages, 1970. But Stephen Hawking and Penrose, in that groundbreaking paper, made the point that if we can demonstrate that the theory of general relativity reliably describes the dynamics of the universe, then there must exist a cause that brings the universe into existence independent of matter, energy, and all the space-time dimensions along which matter and energy are distributed. Bottom line in that paper, time must be created when the universe is created. The space dimensions must be created when the universe is created, as well as matter and energy. And so proving the theory of general relativity proves the unique biblical doctrine of a transcendent creator that creates the universe independent of physical reality. And the Bible is the only holy book that teaches that doctrine of creation. Well, if you picked up the second edition of Beyond the Cosmos, you'll read in there some statements to the effect that the theory of general relativity ranked at that time, which was 6 months ago, as the best established principle in all of physics because of all the different ways we can test the theory of general relativity and how well it passes those experimental tests. So this is kind of icing on the cake. It's one more arena where general relativity has made a prediction and it's passed the test with flying colors. And so now it just makes general relativity that much more the best proven principle in all of physics. What they came up with here is this, is that the theory of general relativity predicts that in the presence of very strong gravitational fields, the kinds of gravitational fields you would encounter as you're being sucked into a black hole, for example, or getting into too close of an encounter with a neutron star, that before this gravity destroys everything, there would be this semi-stable orbit. So very close to the neutron star, the black hole, would be this semi-stable orbit. What do you mean by semi-stable orbit? Where you get this regular orbit that has these little oscillations built into it, and the oscillations will inevitably cause the material in that orbit to get sucked into the neutron star or the black hole. But before that happens, you get this quasi-stable orbit. And this quasi-stable orbit, according to general relativity, will cause oscillations to take place in the X-ray radiation of that neutron star or black hole. And in here, seven astronomers report their attempts to measure these X-ray oscillations. And now they got accurate enough measurements to demonstrate that the oscillations are there and that it definitely points to this quasi-stable orbit at just the right place and just the right quasi-stability that general relativity predicts. So it's a rather smashing piece of experimental evidence demonstrating the reliability of general relativity. And it's an area where astronomers thought they would never be able to pull it off because the observations are so difficult. Yes?
Is there something special about the X-ray range of electromagnetic spectrum that
Okay, the principle here, Greg, is this, is that the closer you get to a black hole or a neutron star where material is being accreted, you know, a neutron star doesn't have to accrete material, a black hole definitely will. But as it gets really close where the gravitational fields become exceptionally strong, the closer you get, the stronger the gravitational field, it will generate radiation that can escape the gravity of that neutron star or black hole that will be at very high frequencies. And the closer it gets, the higher the frequency. So matter that's on the verge of being destroyed by a black hole or sucked into a neutron star will radiate the signature of that destruction at X-ray and gamma ray wavelengths. Gamma ray is even a shorter wavelength than X-rays. Yeah, kind of, exactly. So, no, I mean, as astronomers look at material being sucked into a neutron star, for example, they notice at the greatest distances it's radio wavelengths. Then you see infrared, visible, ultraviolet. And the closer you get, the higher the frequency. So, and the greater the instability. I mean, as the frequency goes up, the instability of that radiation also goes up. And so X-ray bursts, gamma ray bursts are common here. And that's mainly what you expect is a lot of erratic bursting activity. But the theory of general relativity predicts that there will be this zone where you get this quasi-stable behavior. And that's what they found, just as exactly as general relativity predicted. So that just underscores once again that Stephen Hawking and Roger Penrose's paper, the space-time theorem of general relativity, is accurate. After all, it has only two conditions. Universe contains mass, and it's governed by the equations of general relativity. Nobody doubts that the universe contains mass, but for many years there was doubts about general relativity. I think we have less doubts about general relativity now than we do that the universe contains mass. And that bothers you, step on a bathroom scale. Okay. Yes. Does this lead to any more credibility for Hawking's idea about virtual pars, virtual particles and virtual particle separation? Well, the virtual pair idea is an outgrowth of the theory of quantum mechanics. But general relativity combined with quantum mechanics predicts that in black holes, virtual particles can be separated. Now, maybe I need to explain what virtual particles are. What quantum mechanics tells us is that instabilities in the space-time fabric of the universe by themselves have a capacity to pop particles into existence. Just like special relativity, E equals mc squared, says that you can convert matter into energy and energy into matter, general relativity takes it one step further. That we can get matter out of space curvature. And so if you can quantum fluctuate the space-time fabric into a sharp enough space curvature, you got the potential of producing this particle. However, the uncertainty principle of quantum mechanics demands that that particle produced by that quantum fluctuation in the space-time fabric must return to the space-time fabric before any human observer can tell that it's there. And you say, well, what good is all this? Well, not much, except that it is able to demonstrate that a lot of interesting physics that we thought was going on really is going on. And by the way, we do have particle accelerator experiments that demonstrate indirectly that virtual particle pair production really does take place. And if you're curious about how fast it has to pop back into the space-time fabric, it's way under a trillionth of a second. So, however, what Stephen Hawking pointed out many years ago is that in the physics of black holes, where black holes shrink down to a dimension smaller than that exhibited by a quantum entity. In other words, if a black hole were able to shrink down to, say, the cross-section of a proton or an electron, that therein might lay the possibility for virtual pair particles to be separated. Now, if that takes place, one of the virtual pairs is a real particle that you get to keep. Okay, so it could actually escape the black hole and carry mass and energy with it. And this is really what catapulted Stephen Hawking to fame, this idea that black holes will go white. So, you know, what's a black hole? It's an object so highly condensed, so massive that its gravity sucks everything that gets close enough to it. But what Stephen Hawking pointed out years ago is that if it shrinks down to quantum dimensions, then quantum tunneling would allow all the stuff that got trapped inside the black hole to escape through virtual particle pair separation. Now, as I mentioned in Beyond the Cosmos, Hawking didn't really show us how that can happen. He just speculated that the theory should permit that to happen, but never gave us a solution. Why? The solution doesn't work in four space-time dimensions. And as I mentioned in the second edition of Beyond the Cosmos, 10-dimension creation does provide the solution for how these virtual particles can escape and carry not only matter and energy with them, but entropy and information. So we now have a complete solution to the white hole problem that Stephen Hawking first proposed. And what's going on here is these virtual pairs, virtual particle pair, that must return into space-time fluctuation before any human observer can detect it. The gravity is so intense that it separates the two virtual pairs. One of them becomes real, the other one remains virtual, and that one is able to escape through quantum tunneling. And so, yeah, all black holes will go white if you wait long enough. You say, how long? Well, even the tiniest black hole that the laws of physics would permit, which would be a black hole that contains the mass of Mount Everest, would take 16 billion years to go from black to white. So that explains why astronomers have never seen a white hole. By the way, if black holes did exist that were that tiny, astronomers should see a few white hole events. Because if the average is 16 billion, a few of them might go white in 12 billion years. And the universe being now 14.9 billion years old, plus or minus half a billion, we should see a few. We don't see any at all. And that's what convinces astrophysicists that there are no small black holes in the universe. The smallest black holes would be black holes of about 1.5 times the mass of our star, the Sun, and up. And if they're that big, then we're looking at quadrillions of years before they go white. So the white hole thing that elevated Stephen Hawking to worldwide fame actually has no practical use. So, was there a hand? Yeah, go ahead.
I think related, a little bit different, looking at one of the government websites last week, they are having some hearings on some experiment or another at the Linear Accelerator in New York, which is going to be attempting to recreate the conditions of the Big Bang. And the hearing was concerning the probability, which apparently is within an arbitrary neighborhood of zero, but so probable, that so positive that they will not recreate the Big Bang, but will instead create a black hole. Is this, in fact, something that one should be pondering, or is that just complete government bureaucrats getting out of control, worrying about?
Well, that's one scenario. I've heard an even more outlandish one, that these particle accelerator experiments run the risk of creating another universe. Okay, so that and the creation of that universe might do considerable damage to the particle accelerator site and the whole planet, for that matter. So, but these ideas, the one I heard and one you heard that's not quite so outlandish, are both predicated on the assumption that there is a breakdown in the laws of physics before you get to the Big Bang temperatures and densities that would be reminiscent of the creation event of our universe. And, you know, if the laws of physics break down, that really puts you into a metaphysical arena where you say, well, if the laws of physics break down, then we're free to speculate anything we want. You know, anything is possible. And that's where these ideas arise from. And it's a little bit outdated in the sense that this 10-dimensional creation calculation that we now have, thanks to research at Caltech and UC Santa Barbara, establishes that the laws of physics hold all the way back to T equals zero, the moment of creation. So whereas 10 years ago, 5 years ago, physicists said, well, we can only prove experimentally that our laws of physics hold all the way back to 10 to the minus 33 seconds, and then we had some hint that maybe as far back as 10 to the minus 43, and after that we don't know, we now have evidence that it actually holds all the way to T equals zero. That being the case, there is no room for these metaphysical speculations. So I'm not worried about that particle accelerator. In fact, what gives me some encouragement is they may now have within their means the equipment to more rapidly detect the Higgs boson. As I mentioned in Beyond the Cosmos, that's probably the next big step in experimentally verifying that creation indeed is God bringing into existence 10 space-time dimensions, not just length, width, height, and time. In fact, there was an atheist physicist who wrote a book on this hoped-for discovery, the Higgs boson. You know what he titled the book? The God Particle.
Mm-hmm.
And mainly that the entire physics community is aware that this Higgs boson is packed with philosophical and theological significance. And my, I'm way off the subject here. I mean, if you want to know what's going on here, is that this 10-dimensional creation model, which predicts that the cause of the universe not only brings into existence matter, energy, length, width, height, and time when he creates the universe, but 10 space-time dimensions. And let me take my wife's cue again. The bottom line to all of that is this. Only the Christian faith amongst the religions of the world gives us a doctrinal set that's impossible to work out if only 4 space-time dimensions exist and God is confined to operate within those 4 space-time dimensions. The Bible is the only holy book that presents us with a theology that transcends the limits of human visualization. So the demonstration of 10 space-time dimensions is very significant for proving the Christian faith and demonstrating that the other religions of the world are humanly crafted inventions only. Okay. What this 10-dimensional creation calculation predicts is that for every particle that would manifest the properties of mass, things like electrons, protons, neutrons, there would be a complementary particle that regulates the force interactions of that particle. And the particles that have these matter-like characteristics we call fermions. And the ones that have these force-regulating characteristics we call bosons. Now then, one great success is this. Particle physicists have found in their particle accelerator experiments both fermions and bosons. But the theory, the 10-dimensional creation theory, predicts that every fermion will have a boson pair. And particle physicists have yet to find even one fermion-boson pair. We got fermions, we got bosons, but we haven't found two that are related to one another. And we can find these two that are related to one another, then that would be a huge step forward in the eyes of the physicists of proving this 10-dimensional creation calculation. Now, as I argue in Beyond the Cosmos, we already have adequate evidence. But it's kind of like this thing on general relativity. It never hurts to have more evidence. That always helps in convincing the skeptics. And so there's this search. And see, the Higgs boson has been calculated by our particle physicists to be the easiest fermion-boson pair to detect. It's still difficult, far more difficult to pick up than, say, the top quark, which was the last big news particle that they found. This is more massive, which needs to mean more energy to find it. But two particle accelerators, one outside of Chicago and Batavia, and one outside of Geneva in Switzerland, have enough power to have the potential of detecting the Higgs boson. And both of those particle accelerators are in a race to see who will be the first to find the Higgs boson. Say, how long is it going to take? Well, our calculations demonstrate that if it has the mass that we think it has, then we're looking at about 15 years to pick it up. The good news is they've been collecting data for 10 years already. And they now have some new back-end equipment, which is going to help. So optimistically, maybe 3 more years, we'll have the Higgs boson nailed down. But because it is so philosophically significant, I think it's like the COBE satellite thing. They're going to wait until they're really sure before they announce it to the public. There's been some rumors that they already had hints of it already, but I'm sure they're going to wait till they're really certain before they cause a big disturbance. By the way, that thing that the government killed in Texas would have been able to find that thing in less than a week. So instead of 15 years, you'd find it in 1 week, but hey, it's $8 billion. I mean, who wants to spend $8 billion finding a God particle, okay? So, Yeah, well, I think you know where my sympathies lay there. Well, you know what? I was going to talk about this design evidence in our galaxy, but in view of the time, I'm going to save that till next time I'm with you. So let's move into what we're going to talk about in Genesis here. Okay. We were talking last time. If you're new, by the way, this is a science and the Bible segment we're in right now, where we're going through the Bible that touches on science and looking at all the evidence that we have that the Bible is scientifically accurate and has two slants to it. Dealing with those concerns of secularists that the Bible's teaching scientific nonsense, and then also trying to pick up things that the seculars haven't even seen in their criticism of the Christian faith and say, look, if the scientific content here doesn't this demonstrate the complete accuracy of the Bible, not just for faith and practice, but for all disciplines of knowledge. And we've made it all the way to Genesis chapter 7, starting in Genesis 1. I don't know how long it's taken us to get there, Tom. 2.5 years? All right. Well, that's because those early chapters of Genesis really are loaded with a... By the way, we started the science... Yeah, well, okay. I was going to get defensive here, but I won't. Okay. But it's those early chapters of Genesis that really contain the bulk of the scientific content that can be tested by secular scientific research today. So we will be picking up the pace as we move throughout the rest of the Bible. So, but we're looking at a really fun passage or portion of this is the flood. Genesis 6, 7, 8, and 9 focuses on the Genesis flood. And as I've mentioned to you before, this generates more controversy and more skepticism among secularists than any other portion of the entire Bible. Now, that wasn't true 100 years ago, but it is true at the end of the 20th century that this is the portion of Scripture that generates the most doubt in the eyes of secularists. In fact, Dave, that whole program we were talking about, those were the issues that came up. I wasn't even there to talk about the flood, but the over the phone lines, guess what the calls were all about. And it happens pretty consistently. And the big issue here, we've been dealing with several, but the biggest issue of all, who can possibly believe a Bible that teaches that there was a flood that wiped out the entire planet and was responsible for all the geology and all the fossil evidence we see in the face of the earth? A lot of people believe that that's what Genesis teaches. After all, that's what Christians have been telling them for the last few decades. And there's lots of scientific evidence that this is very difficult to support on a scientific basis. But as we've been pointing out here, the problem here is a misconception. By the way, most secularists that I hear calling in on the radio, disturbed about the Bible teaching this nonsense of a global flood, I've discovered have not read Genesis 6, 7, 8, 9. So it's always fun for me to say, well, who taught you or who told you that the Bible teaches that the flood covered the entire planet? Or who told you that all the fossils were formed? Or who told you there were dinosaurs on board the ark? Or who told you that all the life forms came from there? All the mountains were built during the flood. See, these are some of the myths that have been propagated about Christians' belief about the Bible, what the Bible teaches. And by the way, that's not unique. I also run into people who say, well, how can you believe Genesis? Everybody knows it teaches that the world is flat. And it's always fun to say, well, where's the chapter and verse? In fact, I ran into a physics professor on a university campus. I was sharing the platform with him. That was kind of the main theme of his talk and rebutting my talk was, well, everybody knows Genesis teaches that the world is flat. But, of course, nowhere in the Bible does it teach that the world is flat. In fact, the Bible teaches rather explicitly that it's spherical. The big problem there is he was quoting the verses, which aren't even in Genesis, by the way. They're in other books about, well, doesn't the Bible speak about the four corners of the earth? And that's in the Hebrew, and actual Hebrew metaphor there is the four quarters of the earth. And the picture there is the four quarters of the earth, like the four quarters of an orange. You know, very different from the four corners of a flat piece of paper. Then, of course, you've got Isaiah 40, which states that God looks down on the orb or the circle of the earth. Hey, I'm off the subject again. Back to this. The misconception here is that people look at Genesis and see that it teaches a universal flood, and they assume that means that it's a global flood. And so this is for our kickoff point. The universality of the flood does not necessarily imply that the flood is global. It simply implies that all humanity was destroyed except for those on board the ark, and all the birds and mammals associated with humanity were destroyed except for those on board the ark. In fact, we're going to get down to this one here. The Genesis text makes it really clear that lower animals are excluded. You know, English readers do a very quick reading of Genesis 6, 7, 8, 9 and assume that it's inclusive of all the animals. All the animals are wiped out. As we're going to see, the text doesn't say that. It limits its comments to the higher animals, the birds and the mammals. And for good reason, these are the only creatures that can be negatively impacted by human sin. And it's more limited than that, as those birds and mammals that have had close enough contact with human beings to experience that negative impact. As I've said before, we've got good evidence that in Bible times, human beings had not yet settled Antarctica. In one sense, it's not even settled today. And therefore, there's no way that the emperor penguins would have been negatively impacted by the reprobate behavior of human beings, since they weren't even within thousands of miles of the nearest human beings. And that's why I believe there were no emperor penguins on board the ark. But we'll do a little word study to demonstrate that the text does limit its comments to birds and mammals. I think part of the myth here is driven by the fact that people open up the book of Genesis and they say, well, it says here all the creatures were destroyed. But the Hebrew word for creatures is nephesh, the soulish animals. It's not referring to the 1 million species of beetles in the Amazon jungle. It's more limited than that. So universality does not necessarily imply globality. And by the way, last time I was here, several of you said that you really appreciated this discussion of Genesis 8. Remember that couple of verses where we have Noah on top of the ark and he sees the mountains and the hills of the receding waters of the flood? This is, you know, several months after the flood waters have stopped coming down under the heavens and coming up from the fountains of the deep, and the waters are receding. And after a while, he's able to see the hills and the mountains, but he releases a dove. And the dove, it tells us there in Genesis 8, I think it's verse 7, that there was water over the whole face of the earth. And this is an excellent example of universality. From the dove's perspective, the water was universal. Water over the entire face of the earth. But from the perspective of Noah, it was a limited extent because he could see the limits of the waters of the flood. And several of you asked if I could explain how that could be. So I'm going to go to the blackboard. I think this will probably be the closest blackboard for me to get to with this. And because I did this little diagram in the Q&A time after the class, and they said, you know, let's give this to the whole class. And what it really is a cross-section of Noah's Ark. We're told that Noah's Ark was, 450 feet long by 75 feet wide, 45 feet deep. And therefore, it probably looked like this. It may have been like this, or I'll just make it simpler than that. We'll just assume that it kind of looks like this. And we're told that it had three decks. So we got these different decks here. Yes? Okay, yeah, it looks like a U here. And what we're doing is doing a cross-section through Noah's Ark. So we're looking at it as if you're looking at it end-on with a slice taken out. And so here's the hull of Noah's Ark. We got the three decks here. We're told that the Ark was covered over to keep the rainwater out. And that's basically all it tells us in the text. But there was this hole where air could come in and Noah could go outside and take a look. Fresh air, all that kind of stuff. But you got to keep the rainwater out, so different artists have speculated that maybe what Noah built was something like this. Okay? So he had a nice, good-sized eave here, and he probably had the ark sloping like this, the top deck of the ark sloping downward, kind of like this, and maybe this roof even was a little bit sloped, kind of like this perhaps. And again, I want to remind you, this is all speculation. The Bible doesn't really tell us, but it does tell us that the ark was tight in the sense that water couldn't keep into these three decks below. And so maybe it looked something like this. So here's the scenario. The waters are receding. Here's the water, kind of like this. And Noah gets up on top of the roof of the ark. So here's Noah up here, and he's looking out. And he notices that he can see mountains over here. Okay? And when he releases the dove, he probably set the dove free at maybe this level or this level. And so the dove would be flying right up over the water. And because the dove was either released, doesn't tell us exactly where Noah released the dove, but he could have released it here, here, or here. And here's his dove flying over the water. And all the dove can see is water everywhere. Dove can't see these distant mountains. But because Noah's on the peak of the ark, he's easily able to see the distant mountains that the dove could not see. So that kind of explains what's going on in Genesis 8, verses 3 through 7 and 8. Yes? Yeah, this assumes that the dove doesn't fly higher than where Noah is standing, or may also assume that the dove may be a bit nearsighted. I don't know.
Doves are stupid. Yeah.
So... Well, the text does say, in the context of the dove, that there was water over the whole face of the earth, which means that all the dove was seeing was water and nothing but water. And the dove returned, because there was no place to land. Now, Noah here could see that there was a place to land. And he could have said, hey, Dove, all you had to do is keep flying another 15 miles, and you would have found a place to land. The Dove flies out for maybe half a mile and says, boy, all there is out here is water. I better head back to the ark because I'm not going to make it. So that's kind of the context of what's going on. What I want to share with you in terms of, you say, well, is this in like 10, 15 feet of elevation will extend your horizon about a factor of two. You'll be able to see objects twice as far away being 15 feet higher than someone who's right down on the ground. So it does make a big difference as to how far away you can see, just even getting a few feet of elevation advantage. So the explanation of Genesis chapter 8, verses 3 through 9, is that those few feet would make a huge difference from Noah seeing that the floodwaters were now limited to the dove seeing no limit to the waters of the flood. Yes.
Little bitty land bird out in the middle of all this vast water, you know, and certainly that dove is trying to find a place to land, some place. Land bird, not a sea bird.
Well, you know, maybe the ocean example you're giving is better. I mean, all of us have read these sailing novels in our youth, and, you know, the crow's nest, where you send a sailor up to the crow's nest, and it's amazing how much more that sailor in a crow's nest can see than the captain is on the deck. And, you know, we're only talking like 20 feet of advantage, but it makes a huge difference in what you can see. That's because the earth is round. You know, when the earth is round, where you are relative to the surface makes a big difference about how much more of the around the earth you can see. Okay, let me just review where we kind of picked off last time, quickly, I guess. We noted that as you go throughout the Bible, there are countless verses, not countless, but there are a good dozen places in the Bible where it uses terms like the entire face of the earth or the whole world, and it clearly means much less than that. And I won't go through all those different verses, but they're throughout the Old Testament and the New Testament where we see lots of examples of that. And we need to again emphasize the point that as 20th century citizens, naturally, when we talk about the whole face of the earth, we mean the entire planet because we're global citizens. But hey, in Solomon's day, which is one of the examples, the other example we gave was Joseph. All the peoples came to Joseph from all over the world. And the text makes it really clear we're only talking the Egyptian Empire. That was the entire world of Joseph. Just like for the citizens of Rome, their entire world was the extent of the Roman Empire. This point we've discuss considerably the fact that there's a principle throughout the entire Bible. And again, we're outlining here, if you want to deal with controversies in a chapter of the Bible, it's always good to do a sweep of the entire Bible to see what else it's got to say in the same theme. And we notice when we go throughout the entire Bible that we get the principle, the conservation of God's wrath. That God's judgment wrath is always limited to the extent of human reprobation. So the expectation here is that God's not going to pour out judgment wrath beyond the boundaries of human reprobate behavior. And if that's limited to one portion of the planet, then God's judgment wrath likewise will be limited to that one portion. Sodom and Gomorrah is a great example of this. God's wrath was limited to just the five cities of the plain. He left alone the wicked Amorites because their wickedness had not yet reached that proportion. Number four, which was a new one we talked about last time, the fact that the Bible tells us that we're dealing with a limited supply of water. Genesis 7 tells us where the waters of the flood came from, the underground aquifers and the rain clouds, and that even if we were to expand that to include all the water resources of the planet, we wouldn't have enough water to cover the mountains on the face of the earth. That would require 4.5 times the total water content of the entire planet if you wanted to do that. And the text makes it very clear, we're not talking the oceans. We're only talking the rain clouds and the underground aquifers. A lot of water, but it's not 100% of the water content of the planet. And why is that important? Because Genesis chapter 8 tells us the waters of the flood return from whence they came. But Genesis flood waters are still here. And so if the global flood proponents would be accurate, they'd have to explain what happened to all the water. Because Mount Everest should still be covered with water. Obviously, it's not covered with water. The water returned from whence it came. It's still here. And the total sum of that water is not adequate to cover the mountains. Now, people promoting the idea that Genesis really does teach a global flood say, well, we're aware of that, of course. But the way we're going to get around the problem is we're going to throw in a whole lot of erosion during the 40 days. And have all these high mountains eroded practically down to sea level, have all the ocean basins filled up, and that will give us water over the whole face of the earth. And then during the next year, we're going to have lots of earthquakes and volcanoes that will pop those mountains back up and drop the ocean basins back down. One biblical critique of that, there's not a hint in Genesis 6 through 9 that anything like that happened. In fact, it speaks about Noah and the animals and the people with him in the ark being relatively undisturbed during that 12-month episode that they were waiting for the waters to recede. And if you throw in that much tectonics and erosion during the 40 days and during the year later, you're not going to get this ark undisturbed. In fact, the ark will be totally destroyed. You won't even be able to find a sliver left in the ark, let alone 8 people alive and the birds and mammals with them alive. So you've got a problem there. And several of you have pointed out to me that the situation is actually more extreme than that. The global flood proponents, because they're trying to explain all the geological features on the planet with the one global flood, are actually proposing about 6,000 to 7,000 miles of plate tectonic activity, not just the 80,000 vertical, or probably 60,000 vertical feet, but actually 6,000 to 7,000 miles of horizontal movement, because they're trying to explain how the continents formed. Because we have lots of geological evidence that the Earth at one time had one continent that split into the 7. And they say all that happened during the flood. Well, hey, 6,000 to 7,000 miles of plate tectonic movement, you're not even going to get the oceans surviving that event. So, again, some of you can remember back to an earthquake. There was one that happened here in Sierra Madre where the ground moved 2 inches. Okay, and it was a real shaker. Multiply the 2 inches up to 7,000 miles, and you can easily calculate that the oceans will, and the atmosphere for that matter, would be destroyed. Yes?
Other evidence that I thought of is that if the flood was global, the chances of Noah landing in the same valley that he took off from would be really small. Probably if land couldn't land anywhere on the earth.
Yep, and especially if you got the ground moving 6,000 to 7,000 miles in that period. He's not even going to recognize the continent anymore. So, this is probably the most critical comment we could make on global flood interpretation in Genesis, as it is not only biblically absurd without biblical support, but you get into, and by the way, this is the one issue that causes secularists to look at the Bible and say this can't possibly be the Word of God because this is utter scientific nonsense. The problem is there are Christians running around teaching this without ever working out the implications. You know, one of the things that disturbed me about this Kansas thing, both sides hadn't worked out the implications of their position. I mean, you know, all you need to do there is say, well, if you're going to invoke that much tectonics, how much energy gets released? Is that energy reasonable compared to what the Bible says about the survival of Noah and the ark and the fact that we still have an olive leaf that can be plucked afterwards? I mean, that's interesting. We're going to get down to that. This dove came back with an olive leaf. You know, that does limit how much catastrophe you can build into your interpretation. the fact that this olive tree was still there, the olive leaf was there, etc. Okay, I think I've run out of time. What I really want to get to next time we get together is a detailed word study of Genesis 7 and 8 as it pertains to the animals that are mentioned, because I think that's a major misconception. People read Genesis and think it's referring to all animal life, when in fact it's really limited to birds and mammals. And what we're going to do is we're going to look up the 8 different Hebrew words that are mentioned in the text every time it talks about an animal or a bird, and see what it means, and demonstrate that there is no basis biblically for including lower animals. Final comment. What was the purpose of Noah?
Releasing the dove.
Okay. He sees that there's hills and mountains out there. He may not have had the telescopes to actually measure how far away they were. So one of the reasons why he may have released the dove is to say, well, I wonder if the waters have receded enough that that dove could make it somewhere. So instead of sending out a little rowboat and seeing how far he could row, he decided to send out a dove. It's a little bit cheaper in terms of energy expense. And then just see what happens. And he noticed he did the experiment twice. So he sends a dove out, the dove comes back. And he says, well, I guess we have to wait a little longer. And then he sends out a dove again. And the dove comes back with his little olive leaf. And he says, aha, the dove was able to get somewhere where the waters had receded a bit. He waited a little bit longer, and then he said, now we can park the ark and we can leave this place. He was probably suffering from cabin fever, my guess. So, okay, let's pray. Father in heaven, we thank you for the opportunity to be living at the end of the 20th century when so many exciting new evidences for the accuracy of the Bible are taking place right before our eyes. Lord, I pray that you would equip us and send us to communicate this good news to people here and around the world. Help us too, Lord, in dealing with objections that people have to taking the Bible as the error-free word of God, to guide them through their mental and spiritual roadblocks to the text that they're looking at. Lord, let's find ways, creative ways, that we can encourage people to read the text for themselves. And Father, I pray that you would help us to deal with these issues of concern and controversy in such a manner that we can bring peace and reconciliation and resolution, not just within the body of Christ, but outside the body of Christ as well. In Jesus' name, amen.